Years ago, coal companies didn't have to clean up after themselves, and those old coal mines have left their mark.
See this lighter colored material that you can see on top? When it rains, this is like the instant coffee of mine drainage.
I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, Pennsylvania was making good progress cleaning up abandoned coal sites. But ironically, the decline of the coal industry means cleanup money is drying up. Also, we take a familiar journey with a childhood friend.
All right, Charlie. Neighborhood of make-believe.
Turns out Mr. Rogers might have been a little more radical and green than we remember. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. President Obama gave his final State of the Union address this week and defended his administration's push for clean energy sources like solar and wind.
Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future, especially in communities that rely on fossil fuels. We do them no favor when we don't show them where the trends are going. And that's why I'm going to push to change the way we manage our oil and coal resources so that they better reflect the cost they impose on taxpayers and our planet.
Coal production has been slowing down in Pennsylvania, in part because of the high cost. That's actually bad news for the cleanup of hundreds of old abandoned coal mines. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that's because the money to clean up those old mines comes from a fee on active mining.
About an hour south of Pittsburgh, Eric Cavazza scrambles up a steep hillside of loose rocks and pebbles.
Get up here. There is a wooded hollow over this way.
Cavazza is head of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's Abandoned Mine Program. He's leading me up a coal refuse pile. It's basically a hill made out of coal mine tailings. There used to be a mine here in the small village of Fredericktown. This pile is all that's left of it.
And this is all the waste material which was trammed back up on the hill. They had a big conveyor that brought it back up and just dumped it.
The pile literally backs up onto people's houses here. Hardly any trees will grow on it. It's unstable, and it's a nuisance for the town below it.
The material erodes off here. It erodes into the river. It erodes into small streams. It blocks the storm sewer system in the towns.
The pile was created before modern environmental regulations required mines to clean up their mess. Decades ago, companies just left piles like these behind when a mine stopped making money. Pennsylvania has been left with hundreds of these sites, the most of any state in the country.
We were a leader in mining for a very long time, fueled a couple world wars and the Industrial Revolution. So unfortunately, we're left with many problems from that.
Cavazza would like to clean up this pile, but his funding source keeps shrinking.
I definitely think had we continued to get the grants the size we were getting about 3 or 4 years ago, this project would be done probably within the next couple of years. But we're at the reality now where these really large dollar value projects, we're probably only going to be able to tackle maybe one per year. So, and there's a lot of them.
What's happening to that money? Lots of things, including the budget sequester implemented by Congress a few years ago. That's taken millions out of the state's cleanup program. Also, there's this. The federal government pays for abandoned mine cleanup by assessing a fee on current coal production. And as current production takes a nosedive, there's simply less money coming in to pay for cleanup. Andy McAllister is with the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation.
We need every scrap of money we can get in this state to fix this problem.
McAllister works to get more federal dollars to pay for mine cleanups, but the economics of the coal industry are working against him. Sitting at his desk, he pulls out a sheet of paper with production figures from the last available year, 2013.
Look at the coal. For the first time in two decades, as of 2013, U.S. coal production fell below 1 billion short tons. It's now, as in 2013, 984 million short tons.
Pennsylvania officials estimate the slowdown in coal will lead to about a 6% decline in mine cleanup money this year. The shortfall in funding will slow efforts to clean up what is essentially a slow-motion environmental catastrophe in the region. Abandoned strip mines, refuse piles, and mine drainage have poisoned thousands of miles of streams in coal country. Paul Zemkevich is a water scientist at West Virginia University.
So a lot of these refuse piles are in fairly remote areas, up in headwater locations, and because the acid is so concentrated coming out of these refuse piles, even though the volume is not gigantic, they can wipe out many miles of headwater streams that would otherwise be very valuable.
Mining exposes rocks like iron pyrite and shale to oxygen. When water flows over these rocks, it creates an acidic stew that leaches metals into waterways and lowers the pH of streams to the same level as vinegar.
Fish just can't live in an environment with a pH of, say, 3. That just pickles them. They just don't live.
Pennsylvania alone has 5,000 miles of streams that have been impaired by mine runoff from places like the Fredericktown waste pile. Back on top of the pile, Cavazza shows me one of the culprits, a dark rock with a light frosting on its surface.
You see this lighter colored material that you can see on top. These are sulfate salts. They're from the oxidation of pyrite. This is when it rains. This is like the instant coffee of mine drainage.
By simply grading the pile, capping it with soil, and seeding it with grass, the state could dramatically improve the water quality coming off of it. Cavazza's group did just that with a nearby pile last year. One reason why this site is so pressing for Cavazza is that it isn't just in some remote place. This dump is in the middle of a town, Fredericktown. Just ask Julie Bundy. She lives literally across the street.
The slate dumps. Yeah, when we talk about where we live across from the slate dumps. Everybody knows where that is. I think it's just something that people have accepted as being part of the community.
Standing on her porch, Bundy says the pile isn't so bad during the summer. The leaves on the trees make it so you almost can't see the pile.
The only time I really notice it too much is when the teenagers come down and they want to go up on the slate dumps, either on their quads or dirt bikes.
When she was a girl, her parents wouldn't let her near the dump. She's got little kids now of her own and doesn't like the fact that people she calls shady characters park their cars near her house and go up onto the pile.
I know that my neighbor told me at one time it was a farm. And there was apple orchards and everything on that property, and it was very beautiful at one time, and then this happened.
Bundy thinks it would be beautiful if someday the big pile across the street simply goes away. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Old waste piles and coal mines can also catch fire. Our energy reporter Reed Frazier has a story about that on our website, where you can also find a video of a mine fire. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. In southern West Virginia, they're looking at a unique way to reuse old coal fields. You might call it a 700-pound solution. The Conservation Fund just bought more than 30,000 acres of forested and abandoned mine land to bring back a species that hasn't been seen in the state since the Civil War. Wild elk. Turns out elk thrive in the replanted clearings where coal was once mined. I asked Joe Hankins, vice president of the Conservation Fund, why elk?
Elk were native to the eastern United States, and it's something that just intrinsically and aesthetically we'd love to have back in the state. But elk have also proven to be a wonderful economic development opportunity. In Pennsylvania and Kentucky, Tennessee and Virginia, elk have been reintroduced, bringing folks to parts of the states that they don't normally see. You know, the economic ripple effect of the elk that are in Pennsylvania's elk habitat, you know, is $25 to $40 million a year. Along with those visitations come other expenditures, hotels, restaurants, and binoculars, you name it. And so the ripple effect of this kind of charismatic species could be quite significant to the southern part of the state.
Will there be any changes to the land to accommodate the elk? What does it look like now, and what will it look like?
Much of this area has been underground mined for a century, and then now has been mountaintop removal mined. So there are reclaimed mine sites that are 10, 15, 20 years into reclamation. There's some areas that are just being completed, and there's a few spots that are still actively mined. And what you can see if you look on a map, a Google map, much of this area is forested. It's 80, 85% forested with these patches of mountaintop removal. So it's not a complete moonscape, but it certainly is in recovery. It's grassland. It's a scrub that is really perfect for elk. But it's a project. It's a fixer-upper. It's a project that will take some time. This is very much a project about potential, about vision, and about what could happen.
The land will be used for more than just elk. What are the environmental benefits of the purchase and conservation of this land?
Well, that's really the beauty. I think the elk clearly is what has attracted people's attention. It may have attracted your interview, but the elk habitat aligns with lots of other interesting economic and environmental activities. From an economic standpoint, as we move forward into these projects through our Working Forest Fund, we will endeavor to maintain these parcels as working forest. So they will continue to pay taxes. They will continue to generate timber revenue. So the natural resource base is sustained. But from an ecological or environmental standpoint, there are lots of other species that like the grasslands, grassland birds, golden-winged warblers. I was down on the sites in October and just watched a steady stream of monarch butterflies flying along a ridgeline heading south. So Mother Nature has not forgotten about these sites, and with a little bit of help from skilled biologists and restoration folks, they can be replanted and turned into habitat that will benefit lots of species.
Could this type of restoration be replicated elsewhere on abandoned mine lands?
Yes, the short answer is yes. We think this is a good model that works. But I would flip the question back almost that, you know, we do conservation work across the country in special places, protecting high-value scenic vistas and other ecologies. And I think for us, it's almost a different question, which is we know how to protect big vistas, big landscapes. Can the conservation community, can the tools of conservation be used to protect and conserve and perhaps add value to those properties that folks instinctively might not have recognized as something that needs to be protected, that has a future value? We had an interesting conversation with Earl Gohl, the Appalachian Regional Commission federal co-chair. He asked those of us working in the region to invest with urgency. He says Appalachia is the next great investment in America. And we really believe that. And so while others are perhaps pulling out of Appalachia or pulling out of the coal fields or questioning what the economic and environmental future is, we're there. We see the challenges. We like to work with partners. This is not a project that is the conservation funds. This is a project that is the state of West Virginia's. This is a project that belongs to the citizens and the communities in the coal fields. You know, West Virginia is it's a special place. It's a place you can go and still see the stars on a dark night. It's a place that you can go and have authentic conversations and huge amounts of cultural and industrial history that many of us don't know about. But if you plug in your phone, you've been connected to the coal field. So you have a reason to understand what's happening and what the transition is down there.
I can hear the West Virginia pride in your voice. I know you're based in West Virginia. What does this project mean to you personally or in your work life?
You know, it's really exciting. I talk to people down there. We get the phone calls. There was a huge number of volunteers that were down there putting up elk release pens in the last weekend. People are really excited. They're hungry for good news. They're hungry for an opportunity to pitch in. They're hungry for an opportunity to participate, not to be fenced out, not to be gated out, but to have an opportunity to say, this is ours. So it's an exciting project.
Joe Hankins is vice president at the Conservation Fund. As he mentioned, the land they purchased for elk in West Virginia will be timbered through their Working Forest Fund with support from the Richard King Mellon Foundation, which we should say also supports the Allegheny Front. Gradually, the acres will be turned over to West Virginia and become public lands. And the elk? They'll likely be shipped in from Kentucky. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Many of us grew up listening to this.
It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. It's such a happy...
And having warm, fuzzy feelings for Mr. Rogers, the mild-mannered children's television legend. But what was he really teaching us through our TVs?
You know, he was very edgy. There's no doubt about that.
Are we talking about the same guy with the tennis shoes and the sweater? More on the radical legacy of Mr. Rogers. That's coming up later on the Allegheny Front. Great Lakes water, and who can take it, are in the spotlight again. Some have speculated that the vast water resource could help solve the drought out west. While that might be a pipe dream, we're about to see the first big test of an agreement that bans water withdrawals from the lakes. One city in Wisconsin just submitted its request for water to the governors of the Great Lakes states. Rebecca Williams reports for the Allegheny Front.
The city of Waukesha wants to build a pipeline to the Great Lakes. Waukesha is in southeast Wisconsin, and it's 17 miles from Lake Michigan. It has a radium problem in its groundwater supply. Radium occurs naturally, but it's a carcinogen. Dan Dukniak is the general manager of the Waukesha Water Utility. He says the city's groundwater supply has been depleted over time, and that's increased the radium concentration.
And ultimately, the radium exceeded the federal drinking water standard, and we are now under a court order to come into compliance with that. And the means by which we are going to do that is to develop a new water supply.
The state government is requiring Waukesha to come up with a permanent solution to its radium problem by 2018. Dukniak says their best option for clean water is to get it from the Great Lakes. The city wants to divert about 10 million gallons a day from Lake Michigan, for starters. He says they can do that without harming the lakes. He says they'd treat the water and return it to the lake. But Waukesha can't have any water unless the governors from all 8 Great Lakes states say it's okay. That's because of something called the Great Lakes Compact. The compact bans water diversions. All the land that drains into the lakes is known as the Great Lakes Basin. If you're within the basin, you're allowed to use lake water. If you're outside the basin, you can't even ask for it. But there are a few exceptions. Waukesha is in a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin line, so it's allowed to ask for water. It's considered the first major test of the compact.
I think the heart and soul of the compact is the prohibition on diversions. And the first one outside the gate, really, we have to get it right.
Mark Smith is the policy director with the National Wildlife Federation. He says the decision on Waukesha will set a precedent for other cities and counties that sit on the basin line.
The amount of water that they requested really is insignificant to the impact on the Great Lakes. That's not really the question. It's making sure we get it right and making sure that everything that the compact outlined is followed through.
Smith argues the city's application doesn't meet the requirements of the compact, and it shouldn't be allowed to take Great Lakes water. Peter Annan wrote a book about all of this called The Great Lakes Water Wars.
Well, I think we're at this historic turning point in the history of the Great Lakes Compact, and that this is the first straddling county application for a water diversion since the compact was adopted by Congress and signed by the President in 2008. So we're really into a new zone here in water management in the Great Lakes region.
The city of Waukesha and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources have been working on this application for years, and Annan says they're finally ready to move forward.
The decisions that are made with the Waukesha water diversion application will really be setting the groundwork or the foundation for future straddling county water diversion applications coming down the road.
He says depending on how this goes, other communities from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to Fort Wayne, Indiana that straddle the basin line might put in bids for Great Lakes water in the future. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Lately, the weather here in the East has been wild. At the start of winter, it was so warm that trees were budding. Now it's more seasonable. We've had some snow on the ground and bitter temperatures. These Jekyll and Hyde thermometer readings got us thinking about a recent article in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. Journalist Nate Seltenridge looked at over 50 studies about the health effects of hot and cold weather. And what he found surprised him. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the media have focused a lot on heat stroke and deaths around extreme heat, especially as it relates to climate change, the numbers tell a different story.
Roughly a 2-to-1 ratio of cold to heat-related deaths.
So why do more people die from cold weather than from heat?
More people are exposed to cold and moderately cold weather on more days than are exposed to dangerously hot weather. And that's just because of the climate of our planet. And cold doesn't need to be very cold to be deadly. One can experience hypothermia at moderate temperatures if you're not properly dressed or you get wet. And hypothermia can lead to disorientation and accidents beyond just the physiological effects. you don't think about it because it's an everyday occurrence, but if you live somewhere like London, there's a lot of cold weather, and just statistically it adds up. But also in places like Australia, which is not known for its cold weather, again, cold weather is responsible for both hospitalization and death.
So as climate change becomes a bigger factor maybe in public health, how could this finding about cold weather affect how researchers think about public health?
The focus remains on heat, even though, as one study that I mentioned in the paper found, even by the end of the century with projected, you know, extreme and average temperature increases, cold weather will remain more dangerous. Within the context of climate change, people are still focused on heat because extreme heat waves will be more frequent and also hotter in the coming decades and through the end of the century. And that has important implications for public health. It's an interesting problem. And I think what I tried to get to in the story is that the complexities there have important implications for public health policy and kind of mitigation through, you know, home renovations, for example.
Can you give me an example?
These homes in Australia called the Queenslander. It's a style of building design or architecture that has the house sitting on stilts, or at least a pretty open ground level, so that cool breezes can pass under the house and keep the house well ventilated during the warm, humid summers. The same thing that makes a house comfortable, or that style of house comfortable in the summer, makes it more dangerous in the winter. It makes their home harder to heat.
I was thinking about London and cold and damp, because we have a very similar climate to that in some ways here in Pittsburgh or in western mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. It's very wet. The climate change models predict Pennsylvania will have warmer weather, but also that it will be wetter. We don't think about preparing for cold weather when we think about climate change, but if our weather were to be wetter, then this focus on cold weather, mortality, and health impacts makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and if you have a wetter winter, there's potentially more human health risks there that's not related just to flooding, but also kind of the complete package of weather. When you talk about hypothermia, more people who are outside in moderately cold or cold weather getting wet. Maybe they're outdoor workers or exercising and kind of not properly preparing themselves.
Journalist Nate Seltenrich says hot and cold weather can impact each person's health differently. And it's also very dependent on where we live. His article appeared in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. Here at the Allegheny Front, we've been tracking what's going on where we live through the online almanac icchange.org. Susan in State College logged into icchange to upload her photo of salad greens she picked in her outdoor garden in December. December! That's what icchange is all about. It's a platform to share stories and questions about weird weather and other things you notice outside. Then we find researchers and experts to try to explain what's happening and why. So go to icchange. That's icchange.org. Join Susan and others to help us all get a better picture of how the climate is changing in our region. Pittsburghers have a special love for Fred Rogers, the creator of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Rogers' show was produced at Pittsburgh's public television station, WQED. It was first broadcast nationally in 1968, and the soft-spoken host became a favorite TV neighbor. But Michael Long says there was more going on the show than meets the eye. He's author of the book Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers. The Allegheny Front's Lou Bluin spoke with Long, who says the show was a powerful social commentary that often took on the politics of the day, including environmental issues.
If you want to see just how political Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was, Michael Long says you don't have to look any further than the show's very first episodes on PBS.
Rogers was an uncompromising pacifist. And when Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted nationally in 1968, Rogers used his first week of programming to share his anti-war beliefs.
At the time, the Vietnam War was headline news, and Rogers came right out of the gate with an episode depicting a paranoid King Friday arming up for a war against a force he calls the Changers. He even conscripts his own niece, Lady Aberlin, to guard his kingdom.
But Great Uncle Friday, I wasn't really planning to stay that long.
Yes, well, you have come during a state of emergency, Lady Aberlin, and I have drafted you. Forward, march!
By the end of the week, Aberlin has convinced Friday that peace is a better option. And this, according to Long, is the heart of what Roger's Neighborhood of Make-Believe was all about.
Ultimately, in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe, peace always wins out, and justice always wins out. That doesn't happen in the wider world. So what Rogers does through his program is invite us into an alternative polis, an alternative society. That's a political move on Rogers' part.
And Rogers used this platform to explore all kinds of political issues. Race, feminism, commercialism, and the environment.
So in 1967, there's this environmental organization called the Pennsylvania Resources Council. And they run a campaign called Don't Be a Litter Bug. So Rogers takes notice. And by the following year, he broadcasts episodes with an anti-littering message.
All right, Charlie. Neighborhood of Make-Believe.
In this group of episodes, it's Lady Elaine that plays the foil in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe, having to don a dunce cap when she refuses to stop littering. But it's in 1990, Long says, that we see Rogers at the very height of his creative power on the environment, in 5 episodes in which he explores the issue of waste and recycling.
And in 1990, there were still cities, a lot of cities, that didn't require recycling. And this didn't sit well with Rogers. So he develops this storyline in the Neighborhood of Make-Believe where there's a major crisis. And the crisis is that the neighborhood dump is overflowing with trash and stench.
They're all inside the castle, in the E room. E for emergency. They asked me to fan the smell up to the sky.
And there's a neighboring community called Northwood, and that's where the goats live. And you know, and I do, that goats are experts in getting rid of trash. This is the way Rogers thinks. It's beautiful.
Hope old goat has some good news.
I do too.
Toot toot.
Toot toot.
And the plan is that a team of highly experienced goats from Northwood will come to Make-Believe and divide all the garbage so that it can be recycled. Which is beautiful. Goats, what else?
Long says this creative approach to taking on issues was vintage Rogers. But it's also important to see these political episodes in context. Watch a clip on YouTube here and there, and you might miss what's really going on in the subtext. Because Rogers was most often reacting to issues of the day in subtle, usually allegorical ways. Which begs the question, if Rogers were alive today, what issues would he be taking on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
Had he continued his trajectory of concern for the Earth, I can't imagine Rogers not doing more episodes on the environment, especially given the importance of global warming. How he would do it, who knows? The guy was an incredibly creative thinker. You know, he was very edgy. There's no doubt about that.
Edgy? Mr. Rogers? It's not a word many of us who grew up watching him would use to describe the soft-spoken, cardigan-wearing TV host, but Long insists it will be part of Mr. Rogers' legacy. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
Michael Long is the author of Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers. Link to the book and feel like a kid again by watching the very first nationally broadcast episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood at our website. That's AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Join us again here next time, or find us online. On Twitter, we're at Allegheny Front.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.